second of tonight's speakers, Lisa, will share for 40 minutes or thereabouts.
Thank you.
I'm Lisa, I'm an addict.
I'm Lisa.
And I have no idea what I'm going to say, particularly. And if I sit like this, can you hear me? Yeah. Yes. So I'm all right like this. Good. Good. The one thing that I did say today about this chair was I sent a photograph to my friend of my wellies and I said, wouldn't it be awful if I forgot my shoes? You know, like that kind of thing. And I did. So I, number one, feel a complete lemon with Wellington boots on because I wore them, had to wear them at work because I was on a helicopter pad, which is another story. Not time for that today. And this is how my mind is today, I'm afraid. It's very jumbled and it's very kind of... I was listening to Max and it really helped listening to Max. I was chatting to Shelley a bit and then I saw Arinda, Gary, and I suddenly started feeling really calm, and the fact that I was actually able to laugh, particularly having a bit of a laugh there, me and Arinda, was quite something, because I feel quite grumpy, actually, today and yesterday. And I had... having had many years of recovery, over 20 years of recovery, lots of ups and downs, got through lots of Christmases. I hate to bring up that subject, I'm really sorry, but my Christmas this year was the most horrendous Christmas I've ever had, probably in my entire life. And I know I like to dramatise things, but actually in reality, it really was. It's not the worst time I've had in my life at all, and certainly not in recovery, but actually it was the most difficult time around my family ever. The one brother that's in recovery was bobbing around on a boat on the Isle of Wight, and I thought it was going to be all right, and it wasn't. It was quite boozy, and I just had to get away, and I won't go into details, but the thing that kicked in was the programme of get me out of here, this is really, really not good, this is kind of possibly, you know, could lead me to using, because I felt so awful, and I sort of, again, it doesn't really matter about the details, but the dynamics were so sort of unhealthy in my family, which was just kind of really shocking to me, because I wasn't expecting it. I was not expecting it. And I ended up sort of kind of escaping. I was in the country, and I literally kind of went for a long walk and did the first thing that is in my head, because I've been going to meetings for so many years, which is the beauty of going to meetings, and this is how... on many occasions I've stopped myself using, because I've got it kind of programmed in my head. There's a sort of ring sponsor, ring this one, ring that one, and there's these people that I know I can ring. And thank goodness they were there on the end of the phone, and I was shivering, it was cold. My brother, first person I spoke to, said, don't go all drama, Queenie. You've done a really good thing, you've left, you're safe, now get somewhere warm. And I ended up in a barn, and I'm going to sound like a farmer now because I've got wellies on. And but yeah, I did literally find a barn and spent about an hour crying and talking to people in recovery. And it does all sound very drama queeny, but it was actually just really kind of survival in terms of recovery. And I took my sponsor's suggestions and my brother's suggestions of going back there, getting the one sensible person I could ask, my stepdad, to drive me, who was sober, drive me back to where my mum lives and get the hell out of the place, which was my brother's place, which I did do. And that's how I got through Christmas. And then I checked into B&B with my little dog. And I spent Christmas on my own with my dog, and not on my own, actually, because I had loads of people from the fellowship that I was able to talk to. And I got out of the area as soon as the trains were running. And like I say, all that stuff that was programmed sort of like in a way automatic to me to, number one, say the serenity prayer, hand it over. I was quite calm the way I handled the situation, which was a great big turkey leg chucked in my vegetarian plate of food, which has happened many years in a row. And this was just, to my point, you know, final straw. Had enough. These people are all drunk. Don't want to be around them. These aren't really my family, are they? Those kind of thoughts going through my head. And so in a way, a moment of clarity as to what was all right for me to put up with and what, you know, what isn't. So I felt kind of really, I felt really all right, actually, in that little B&B with my dog, which sounds very pitiful, but it was, yeah, it was really safe and really good. And the people in the place were really lovely to me. As my friend put it in perspective, it's just kind of one day, it's kind of done. My relationship with my entire, I've got a lot of siblings, who I've felt quite close to for many years, and it's taken a lot to build up relationships with them, having, you know, been a real pain as a teenager, say the least, disrupted every wedding. You know, I was either missing in A&E, alcoholic poisoning, drug overdose, just everything like that from a very young age. My brother preceding me, you know, whatever the word is, was doing all of this first, and then I just didn't dream that I was going to end up repeating all the things that he did, actually. So my sort of family, you know, that kind of has kicked up a lot of stuff for me. So whereas I could quite easily feel like I could come here and do a chair quite succinctly, it's quite good, actually, because I'm completely thrown, and like I said, my brain is a bit jumbled, but I do know some basic things, which are the way to stay clean for me, and you know, a day at a time, literally a moment at a time, still occasionally applies a moment at a time. Whereas I can go through quite long periods of just doing the basic stuff for recovery, going to a couple of meetings a week, sometimes going 10 days without meetings, feeling a bit off the wall, so I up the meetings a bit. And I don't really question too much, and then you get these little moments or periods like I've just had, which are actually really good in a way, because they've shaken me up the way I think about what I'm doing, and a lot of kind of a lot of work to be done, I guess, from my perspective. Yeah, from my perspective, and a lot of writing I've been doing as well about childhood. And Max mentioned about the first year, I sort of ran through a lot of stuff. Thought I had done pretty much all the steps after about 9 months. I did all these kind of... I was really, really young when I first came into recovery. I did all these really funny things with this girl that I used to hang out with in recovery too. And say, like, it was 9 months, it's coming up to 9 months clean. So I go to Amsterdam for a couple of days to celebrate and survive staying clean. And then on the boat, get my keyring out. And, you know, it was just really bizarre. I did some really unhealthy things. But as soon as I got to Amsterdam, we went to meetings and we ended up staying in the head office amongst these fish tanks. And we stayed with this man that was quite old and really wise. And, yeah, and he just kind of looked after us. So I've always kind of gravitated to getting to a meeting. I kind of tend to have been rather quite impulsive the way I do things, but then I've got this program, like I say, in my brain that says, you know, don't really know what I'm doing here, but I know that I'm sort of at risk of, you know, kind of going a bit off the rails. So I know, like I said, I've mentioned this already, but, you know, I know the kind of basic things I need to do. And I first got taken to a meeting. As long as I remember, my feelings about myself have just been, I felt uncomfortable with myself, I felt different to everyone else, and I literally had that dis-ease. And when someone told me the word dis-ease, you can break into two, and it's that dis-ease within yourself, it just made sense. And when I heard that in the first sort of meeting, actually, I went to, and I was literally in my teens then, and my first meeting I got taken to was my dad and my uncle. And I literally have to excuse me, that's the word for today. I got shoved in a meeting. I got introduced to everyone. It was about half the size of this. Really embarrassing. I was in Sweden. I had a school uniform on. And they spoke in Swedish and said, you look after her. Can you make sure you sort her out, basically? And that was my first meeting, and I hadn't even reached 14 at that point. I think I was 13. And I was, like I said at the beginning, I was a binge drinker at this point, because they sent me to Sweden thinking maybe if I was to spend time with my dad, it would kind of sort me out, because I think my mum was aware that I was just sort of not quite right. You know, there's something not quite right with me from many years, like I say. I just didn't feel right at school. I just remember, I can remember the first school disco painfully, and all of those experiences that I know other people might pluck one memory from childhood, who, you know, people that I work with might mention one thing. I can remember an awful lot of my childhood being humiliating, and I remember weddings. I remember sort of kicking off at weddings from as young as I can remember, because I didn't like wearing the clothes that I had to wear, or I didn't like the way they did my hair, but it was just fear, because I didn't want to be around a load of people, and I certainly didn't want them complimenting me about what I had on, or what my hair looked like. I just wanted to be invisible and quiet and for people to leave me alone. which is, I guess, when drink, drugs, all of that sort of becomes an answer, or became an answer for me, and was quite relief, actually. As I say, I saw my brother go through, he, from a very young age, just went straight for the drugs, quite a big way. He was in a band, and he, again, about age 13, he just sort of went right off the rails, and I really sort of despised that kind of whole era and the music that he was involved in and all that, and I just was kind of almost quite anti-drugs, ironically. And I just know that it definitely worked until whizzing right the way through my using to the point where I got to what I would call the first bit of my recovery, really, when I first got the whole thing and really was willing to surrender. I was in Australia at this point. I did a lot of travelling. I used to do big, big geographicals to try and think that it was going to sort me out, and obviously you take yourself with you, and it wasn't till I sat in this detox and they told me, you're Rolling Stone, you never stay anywhere, you're always moving, you're always on the move. And I had gone from psychosis, like a drug-induced psychosis, and I was sectioned into this madhouse. It really was so insane. It was a disused... There was this kind of... It was in the papers, there was all this stuff going on. There had been this kind of... bit of a scene going on. It was in Australia, like I say. It was someone had been murdered that day in that psychiatric hospital. So we all got moved from the moment I entered into this place, off my face, quite frankly, and given Largactyl, and then we got taken to this kind of place that they used, disused part of the psychiatric place that they used to make horror films in. And it sounds like I'm making this up, it really does. And I did have someone come up to me once after a meeting and go, was it such and such place? Yeah, I know that place. It is quite a well-known place in Sydney, actually. And I think because I got moments of sanity whilst I was in there, and they recognised clearly that it was a drug-induced psychosis, so they put me in this detox. But those moments of sanity that I got, I was so desperately praying that I wouldn't go back into that kind of state of mind. And I was literally like, I will do anything. I just don't want to ever use again. At that moment, I just didn't want to have the madness back that I had. We got taken to meetings. Regardless, some people actually got taken to... Yeah, anyway, I was going to go right off on a tangent. They got taken to meetings in their pyjamas, and they did. Because this is how well-known this unit is in Sydney. We went to meetings every day. We got told we weren't allowed to talk to each other, apart from we were allowed to talk to each other at the meetings and after the meetings for an hour. We could talk for as long as we liked to people in recovery on the phone. We had to ring people every day. It's almost like they were kind of half doing your programme for you at the beginning because you weren't able to do it yourself. It's just the way it was 21, 22 years ago this was. And from that moment, I've stayed clean. It's kind of quite funny, which is really good. And I got a sponsor early on. I really listened to the thing of don't make any drastic decisions in the first year, apart from if you really have to, like I had to move country back to England because I was illegal immigrant at that time, so I had to come back to England. Being an addict, I worked out if I left when there was this amnesty on, I didn't get a bad stamp in my passport, so I could go back if I wanted. So I kind of hung out to that point, but all I did was meetings, but we were just talking about work. I did actually work because I was supporting myself, and you know, I wasn't in a position where I couldn't work, so I did work. When I came to England, I was completely in shock because the meeting format, this is the only difference, the format of the meeting was different. You got to the meeting in Sydney, you went to the area where the meeting was, you had coffee, you chatted for about half an hour, then the meeting started. And because it was a different format here, and because maybe London wasn't quite as friendly, I don't know, I find it friendly now, so I'm guessing it was my state of mind. I just found it really freaky, and I thought I'm not going to be able to stay clean here because the meetings are just a bit different. But actually, I was wrong because very soon, you know, I kind of got into the swing of it, and that's what I've done. And I ended up in, strangely, in a probation hostel, even though I hadn't been in prison. And that's where I met one of my really close friends who I'm still friends with now. And I do remember this again, this sort of probation hostel was kind of almost anti-12-step. And sorry, I've got these funny thoughts because there's a few people in this room that know my friend here. And we've had a very up and down kind of friendship, and we row, we fall out, we... I throw my dog's water over his head, which I'm not proud of, but I have actually got to the point where he's driven me that mad, and I've driven him that mad, but I don't know what he's done. He's never done anything like that, but he's sworn at me a lot over the years. But he's one of the people I rang on Christmas Day, and I'm really close to him. We don't hang out hugely all the time, but he is sort of like a rock to me, and there was about 10 of us in this place. We used to have to bid for money, and we used to have to something like this ridiculous amount of money, and they used to class it as a luxury going to an NA meeting. So they did this, go, nah, you can't have the bus fare this week, sorry. So me and my friend used to walk to meetings with a cigarette in one hand, coffee in another, and we used to sometimes walk for an hour and a half to get to meetings. And it's like a violin story, isn't it, now? But it really was rough and ready, this place. And of the people that were going to meetings in this place, of the 10 of us, there was 4 of us that were really into going to meetings, and the other 6, sadly, none of them were alive. They mocked us for going to meetings. They took the mickey out of us for going to meetings. They were really negative about it, and we took a few of them along at different points, and they almost got it. And then, sadly, every single one of them over the years has died, and it is really tragic. And I think that as well has given me that kind of real feeling of, if you don't get your backside to a meeting sometimes, you know, or regularly, it's just not going to, you know, hopefully I won't use, but, you know, I don't take it for granted, as I have done on, you know, in many phases of my recovery. I've taken it for granted, and I've been really kind of fed up with meetings and fed up with people. And then I've found it kind of actually at work. I thought, actually, no, people in meetings are right, because you can have ups and downs with people in meetings. Even if it's in 10 years' time or 5 years' time, I've had these situations, and you kind of give each other a hug, and I don't know. Whereas people not in recovery, it's a lot more difficult, I've found. The tools that I've got from coming to meetings, number one, I was painfully shy. I remember in my first year of recovery, I used to say yes to, I was told to try and say yes to everything I was asked to do recovery-wise, that is, of course, like doing chairs and stuff. And I did take that literally a bit, really. Gosh, I'm going to get myself back on track now. And I remember standing up to do a chair at a conference in Brighton, and the only thing that came out of my mouth was nothing, really, apart from tears, and I cried and ran off, and apparently they could hear me crying outside, and that was my chair. And that's the sort of thing that I've kind of done. And then I've sort of... That's why I've got a complete acceptance when I sit down here, because I do the serenity prayer over and over in my head, and I kind of physically do that or mentally do that thing where I'm just handing it over. So I think, you know, I've also really annoyingly giggled the whole way through and tried to do a chair and just laughed the whole way through, which is probably the most annoying thing for people sitting there, and they were getting annoyed, and it was just me and another girl. But it was just, I just couldn't help it. I just couldn't help it. So I've cried, I've laughed, had a cough all the way through, and it was an illness in recovery meeting. That didn't go down too well. Got glared at quite a lot there. I've had to deal with epilepsy in recovery from the beginning. I think it's a side effect of drugs I used to take, or some of the drugs I used to take, I don't know. At first I wouldn't take medication, then I ended up taking medication, and I've been on it for 20 years, and I have occasions where I have seizures, but not often. So I've had that to deal with. I've had cancer, I've had chemotherapy, I've got through that. I've had people again, someone not too far away from me, a couple of people not too far away from me. Just at times when I've really needed, I remember really hurting my foot and getting a parcel of trainers that I could actually walk in from someone not too far away from me. And another one that looked after my dog, didn't you? Yeah, while I was going, yeah, it just all comes back to you. But no, it's just the sort of love that I've had around me from people in the rooms, and I'm going to get tearful if I don't kind of move on quickly. But yeah, I've just found it an amazing experience, and like I say, I've had a kind of an up and down thing occasionally with recovery, and I've had all sorts of stuff going on with work, and nothing kind of phases me too much because I've kind of got this outlet, and I look at other people, and ironically I've noticed my I work in a hospital and I work in another place like as well, and I've noticed the boss in the hospital has a white NA keyring, and he's been all right with me for a year, and he used to be quite difficult, a difficult character, and he's, I think, going to meetings, and we were just talking about how I work in a hotel as well, and a spa in the hotel, though you wouldn't think so with my wellies. It's a very posh spa, and occasionally there's people that come in, and there's just, without barely saying a word, I know they're in recovery, and there's one or two, well, in fact, there's about five people that will only see me. They have the back done, I'm an osteopath, and they're in recovery, they come and have a chat, they kind of touch base, as they say, and then they're from all different parts of the world, and it's really special. And then there's another few that we kind of know each other's in recovery, but we don't ever talk about it because it's quite nice to keep it like that. For some reason, they don't want to, perhaps they just want that peace and quiet, and for some reason they just don't want to be, yeah. So it's really special, actually. And, yeah, I don't know how much more time there is. Is there more?
I've got about 15, 20 minutes.
That's all right then. I can wind back a bit and start again. I won't start talking about my wellies again. I could be really boring, couldn't I? Just talk about wellies for 15 minutes because it's obviously on my mind a lot. I will talk about school discos and my first dancing experience in recovery. It's really my experience of handing something over to the power of my, you know, I can't even say it, higher power, and my kind of first sort of dealing with that extreme self-obsession in early recovery when I was probably about a month clean and I was going to meetings. I'd just come out of this detox. I didn't do a treatment centre at that. I'd been put in one years before, but I wasn't really present. And I do remember sort of my first New Year's Eve, I was very early in recovery, as I say, and I went with some people to this NA dance, and I remember sort of standing on the edge of the dance floor thinking, this is just horrendous. And I thought my life was over anyway, because they used to go to the cinema on a Saturday night, and I used to think, how boring is that? And they used to get really excited about it, and I used to just think it was really dull. And I just thought, just going to have to live with this because you've done all your sort of exciting stuff. And then I went to the NA meeting, NA dance, and just was sort of asking the people, because no one was on the dance floor, everyone was around the edge of it. And I said to my two friends, one was my roommate, how do you dance without drugs and drink? What do you do? And they said, just, this is a really Aussie saying, hang loose and be a jerk and say your prayers and pray to a God, you know, God of your understanding. And just make a fool of yourself, really, is what they're saying. Just, you know, your ego's just got to be exposed here. Big ego, low self-esteem, that kind of odd combination. And so I got up on the dance floor and I said the Serenity Prayer over and over again, and all this dry ice covered us. And I thought it was literally like a pink cloud for me, because I just thought, wow, this is recovery. This is really exciting. Because I was not even 19, I think I was 18 years of age, and it was just really exciting. And I thought, this is it. This is great. I don't need drugs and drink. This is just sort of amazing. And then I carried on really like that for about 5 months. And then I came back to England. And then that's that whole thing where, you know, I started to go to meetings. But that was how I first sort of learnt about handing stuff over and kind of applying the steps. And the steps, it's quite good there's more time because I haven't even really mentioned the steps. And I mentioned the programme, but not really mentioned in that much detail, but really they've kind of come to me at times. I did it in a sense. I did do the first 12 steps in a very fast way in the first year, but it wasn't really thorough, and it was, you know, to the best of my ability. And I think certainly the first three were kind of quite in me from the early stages, because of how dramatic my rock bottom was, that I was clinging on to a God, you know, and meetings were my God for the first year, really. And then it sort of changed a few times as I've gone along. But definitely, you know, coming back to face my family, to face my mum, was quite a moving experience, because although I've had a close relationship with my mum, there's lots of stuff not right about it, and still not right. And it is what it is now, and I've realised, you know, there's only a limit to where I can go with it. However, we had a conversation, and the conversation was really sort of poignant, and it was about my childhood, and it was about how she just couldn't be there for me. And it was just an explanation of, really, she was saying to me, it's not in your head, it was like this, it's kind of, you know, it was a really tough time. The day I was born was just a really kind of weird situation. Like, my dad took an acid trip, and there was this, these horrendous chain of events happened the day I was born, and I, in a way, was treated, because my brothers and sisters saw a lot of stuff happening the day I was born, which is far too long and too, you know, sort of going off on a tangent to be going into. But in a way, the relationship I have with my siblings developed from that experience. And to have a conversation with my mum in early recovery, I would no way have been able to have that conversation had I not been going to meetings. And sort of in a way, like, had a little mini kind of, well, I certainly had a rock bottom kind of mini breakdown of some kind to do with my childhood, and sorted a lot of stuff out. And to be able to hear my mum for the first and only time actually in my life said she loved me, which was because of recovery. And she's never said it since. And she's one of these mums that is very kind and will do practical things, but she sticks her chin out and kind of practically her whole body's recoiling away if you give her a kiss on the cheek, bum in the air. You know, she's just kind of not able to be physical, but she, and that's what I've grown up with. They're sort of family that don't talk about feelings. And to be able to come into meetings and just feel like you're not the only person that has just quite regular thoughts, but thoughts that can actually get me using if I don't sort of use the tools that I've got. And going through step four of going through all the things that have happened, the major things in my life, and looking at my part, and, you know, going further in the steps and seeing some of the stuff that I blame myself for and some of the stuff that I needed to make amends for. Some things I'm still not great. I do remember being, perhaps out of all my brothers and sisters, the worst at saying sorry. I wouldn't say sorry. You'd have to torture me to say sorry, actually. And I missed out on going to the cinema. I missed out on trips because I just wouldn't say sorry for something I had done. But again, the friend that I was in that probation hostel with has taught me as well. He's really humble and good at sort of owning his stuff. And then I was thinking, you know what, we have these little disagreements and he's always kind of owning his stuff and saying sorry, and I'm just standing here like quite smugly and accepting it. And I started feeling really uncomfortable with myself because I was doing the steps at the time relating to my part, looking at my part in things, a lot of written work. And I've really improved my ability to kind of look at events like the Christmas that just happened and look at my part, the other people's part, what I can do to change it, how I can make amends, which is priceless, really, for day-to-day living as well. And like I say, all areas of my life, relationships aren't so dramatically, you know, they're probably one of the most challenging and painful things, I would say, because I can be bumbling along really healthy and then I could have a relationship and, you know, even for a couple of months and it goes wrong, or it doesn't go wrong, actually, it just ends. I end it, they end it, not right. And it can be very, very painful, as I'm sure we all know, at times cripplingly painful. And again, you know, there's that kind of safety net. There's my sponsor I can ring up, and my friend's latest, a couple of my friend's latest phrase is kind of right size it, you know, put it in proportion of like Christmas Day, put in proportion, you've got yourself out, you're kind of all right, you're actually feeling okay, this is the next day, you know, kind of get on with it, get on with your life. And since having the whole experience with cancer and chemo, and having had, someone was talking to me about teeth, and I thought, oh, I'm not going to bore him with this, because I've had like a lot of dental work, like wisdom teeth out, because of the epilepsy, I can't have anaesthesia as easily. I've had circular sores coming at me like this. The side of my eye, I can see this sore. Getting this wisdom tooth out that wouldn't come out and stuff like this. And what got me through, literally, was the serenity prayer and the ability to say, stop, I can't take any more, give me a break. Just basic life. Basic life is what recovery gives me, the ability to get through. And I'm not going to waffle for the sake of it. I'm going to finish there. And thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much.